From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Subsequent to Michael's conviction, the district attorney, the chief investigator were both sentenced into the federal penitentiary and went to federal penitentiary for drug smuggling. The district attorney that handled the case, the assistant district attorney, was imprisoned for bribery and jury tampering. These were criminals in 1973.
The continuing injustice against Michael Perdue. After a coerced confession by police, the Alabama 17-year-old was wrongly convicted for a triple murder. Cleared of the crime 25 years later, he remains in prison for life for trying to escape. And the War and Peace Report. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton is in Macedonia today, and an anti-NATO group called Macedonia Dawn is threatening to disrupt his visit to Skopje. An anonymous woman issued the warning in a call to a pro-Serb television station in town. She says Macedonia Dawn wants to wake up the world to oppose NATO and the United States. The woman also says Macedonia Dawn is responsible for the car bomb that exploded outside NATO headquarters last Friday. That blast destroyed a truck and a four-wheel drive vehicle, but didn't injure anyone. Macedonian police say this is the first they've heard of the group. In New York, a federal grand jury has indicted two more officers in the case of Abner Louima, who was tortured in the bathroom of a police station. In indictments yesterday, 28-year-old Rolando Alaman and 34-year-old Francisco Rosario are charged with lying to authorities investigating the assault on Louima. The indictments came 2 weeks after a jury convicted a patrolman, Charles Schwarz, of holding down Louima, another officer, Justin Volpe, who pleaded guilty to sodomizing Louima with a broken broomstick. Meanwhile, members of a congressional task force investigating police misconduct criticized New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani for skipping a hearing yesterday, but the mayor said he'd nothing new to offer and was busy with other things. The day-long hearing yesterday at the World Trade Center was the first of five planned by the Congressional Black Caucus in response to a rash of racially tinged police misconduct cases, ranging from racial profiling on the New Jersey Turnpike to police shootings in Chicago and Riverside, California. While those testifying at the hearing included high-profile public officials such as former New York Mayor David Dinkins, noticeably absent were Giuliani, as well as the police commissioner Howard Safer and their deputies. Giuliani defended his no-show, saying he had submitted testimony from a similar hearing he attended recently and had little new to add. In Europe, Coca-Cola is doing some damage control. The company has apologized to European consumers for its reaction to a mysterious health crisis being linked to its soft drinks. 2 weeks ago, dozens of Belgian children got sick after drinking Coke products. The European Union says more than 200 people suffered stomach pains, nausea, and hyperventilation. Belgium, France, and several other countries reacted by pulling some Coke products from store shelves. Coke's chair now has taken out full-page ads in Belgium's major newspapers, saying the company was slow to react to the health crisis and apologizes for, quote, any discomfort or inconvenience. Coke has blamed defective carbon dioxide and a wood preservative that managed to get on some cans during shipping. Representatives from more than 170 nations will meet at the United Nations today to assess the status of the Y2K problem. It's feared many of the world's computers will fail come January 1st because old programs will read the year as 1900, not 2000. Countries are pouring money into fixing the potential problem. The head of President Clinton's Council on Year 2000 Conversion says American companies and the government are spending between $80 and $100 billion on Y2K. Meanwhile, Vietnam Airlines has reportedly announced it will not have any planes in the air when the clock strikes 12 on December 31st. The Vietnam News quotes the chief of the airline's technology program as saying all flights will resume once that critical moment passes. It's feared the world's computers will fail and have a ripple effect during the first moments of the year 2000. An attorney representing Nazi-era slave laborers in U.S. lawsuits criticized German companies today for refusing to say how much compensation they're willing to pay in a settlement. The remarks by Melvin Weiss came ahead of new talks in Bonn today between victims' lawyers, industry executives, and officials from Germany, the United States, and East European countries on a slave labor fund that German industry has promised by September. A central sticking point in the talks that began last fall is that German companies want a settlement to quash all lawsuits on behalf of former slave laborers. 16 German companies that profited from Nazi-era slave labor enraged victims' groups this month when they announced details of the planned fund. The groups condemned provisions that payments would only be offered for 6 months of slave labor or longer, and that they would be based on average pensions and the cost of living in claimants' home countries, not back wages. German Chancellor Gerhard Schröder's government has since said the companies were reworking the proposal. And finally, for the first time in nearly 30 years, the border between India and Pakistan, uneasy neighbors, is taking on signs of another possible war. The Pakistani military warned today that hopes for peace in the region are fading.
Vacation in the faraway land. Uncle Sam does the best he can. Now you remember what the draft man said. Nothing to do all day but stay in bed.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The blast that killed two NATO soldiers in Kosovo came from a NATO cluster bomb. That word comes from the British military. Officials say soldiers were called in to clear unexploded devices from a village school outside Pristina yesterday. But when the peacekeepers wired the bombs for demolition, they went off prematurely, killing the two soldiers and two civilians. The deaths were the first for NATO troops since entering Kosovo. And relief officials fear more tragedy as thousands of ethnic Albanians pour back into Kosovo despite minefields and booby traps in the region. We're joined right now by Ken Rutherford. He's co-founder of the Landmine Survivors Network and teaching fellow at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. On December 16, 1993, he lost both of his legs to a landmine while working as a credit union training officer in Somalia. Since his accident, he's testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and given speeches around the world about landmines and survivor assistance. Ken Rutherford, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Well, can you tell us your reaction to hearing that these two British soldiers were, and two civilians, killed as a result of, well, a NATO cluster bomb? Cluster bombs that don't explode become landmines once they're sitting in the ground.
Right. Initially, I was really heartbroken that peacekeepers would be injured by such ordnance or weapons that could be set off by innocent acts, such as disarming it or mistakenly stepping on it. I think this is just the beginning of a lot of casualties for the NATO forces. They're going to be demining a lot of areas where these resources need to be put to civilian use. Collapsed buildings are just the beginning.
Ken Rutherford, can you talk about where international law stands and the United States stand on landmines today?
Well, there's an evolving norm that landmine use is illegal. There was a treaty signed in December of 1997 by 122 states. Since then, it's been signed by more than 140. It entered into force on March 1st, 1999. So states who've signed that treaty are legally obligated not to use landmines, to clear landmines in their soil, and to support victim assistance program. Now, the law is a little more questionable in those states who didn't sign a treaty, and this includes the major powers, and especially the United States. The United States continues to use landmines in Korea. They've always stated that they could use landmines when they project their forces abroad or pretty much anywhere. So the U.S., ironically, in 1994, rhetorically at least, they wanted a ban. President Clinton was the first civilian leader to call for a ban. He did that in a speech in front of the United Nations General Assembly. But yet, 5 years later, we're one of the major holdouts. So, you know, right now, to internet for treaty law, the United States is still legally entitled to continue to use landmines. But under customary law, there may be a question whether or not landmine use is legal or illegal.
Right now, Kosovo has become the most mined landmass in the world. We're talking about what the landmass the size of Connecticut. It now exceeds Cambodia and the number of mines that are there as a result of all sides, including these unexploded cluster bombs of NATO and the United States.
Well, there's going to be two types of types, I believe, a pattern of injuries here. One is the NATO forces, which are going to be clearing areas that they need to operate. These are usually small, fairly well-defined areas, roads, bridges, key buildings. And the second type of mine is going to be humanitarian demining, where you're going to have to clear fields and cities and schools and these type of activities. And that's going to take decades. Well, the NATO forces are not going to be there for more than a couple years, and they're going to be clearing, you know, small, well-defined areas. Well, it's going to be the humanitarian deminers, international NGOs, the United Nations, Kosovo farmers themselves clearing their own land of mines, and that's where a lot of the accidents are going to occur. This could be decades. Take decades to clear the mines out of Kosovo.
So what are you doing about getting the U.S. to sign on to the international treaty?
Well, our major advocacy campaign in the United States is to inform the American public and our policymakers that landmines directly affect Americans. All of our hostile casualties to our peacekeepers in Bosnia have been from landmines. Over one-third of our casualties in Vietnam were due to landmines. Relief workers such as myself are losing limbs and their lives to landmines. American tourists abroad are being injured by mines, journalists, diplomats. So you have a whole range of Americans who are living overseas threatened by landmines. So really, just because landmines are not deployed in our country doesn't mean that landmines directly affect Americans. And so that's one aspect of our campaign, is that landmines directly affect Americans. The second point of our campaign is that the use of landmines should be curtailed and stopped because they're indiscriminate and their military utility is outweighed by the humanitarian costs. And with the world's deepest military arsenal, I believe there's other resources and instruments that we could bring to bear on defending our forces and having them accomplish their jobs.
Ken, I hope it's okay that your guest waits.
What's that?
I hope it's okay that your guest waits.
Oh, no, it's a FedEx.
Okay. Just remember they're non-union. But okay. Can you tell us about what happened to you in Somalia in 1993?
Yes, I was building credit unions in southeastern Somalia to help internally displaced populations and returning refugees, help them jumpstart their local businesses again, their machines, electricity, women's mat making, et cetera. And I went out with my staff to visit a loan applicant's project site when our vehicle hit a mine. It was a right front tire, and I was in the right front seat and ended up losing one leg in the explosion. And then after about 10 surgeries to try to save my other leg, it was amputated in February of 1993. So right now I'm just a bilateral amputee. But, you know, I'm lucky because I'm here, and we're injured out in a remote area. I was with eight, nine Somalis, and we had a radio to call for help, and help came within a half an hour and took us to a local hospital and received some treatment and was medically evacuated to Nairobi and then the following day to Switzerland. So in my first week, I was in about five hospitals in four different countries. and had about 20 blood transfusions there in the first day and a half.
Had you known much about landmines before it happened to you?
No, not at all. I mean, those type of things happen to other people, and that was the last thing I expected that day when I went out. So, total shock. But when I was immediately injured, I knew it was a mine. Because we're in the middle of nowhere, and all of a sudden there was an explosion. And the car filled with dust, and looked down, and one of my feet was off, and my other foot was badly damaged, and I knew I was definitely in trouble, and it was caused by a mine.
Did you ever find out where that mine was from?
Nobody really knows. A lot of people really disclaimed it, but, you know, it could have been left over from fighting from previous years. It could have been left by the local ruling militias who deployed mines on these isolated roads. Nobody really knows, and there's never really been a definitive answer on who deployed it and why.
Ken, what about the companies who make landmines, particularly in this country?
There's not really a company. I think the last contract that was fulfilled by an American firm for landmines is a company outside of Minneapolis called Alliant Tech Systems. And I believe they finished that contract last year. And right now in the U.S. Is not planning to produce any more mines, at least for the short-term foreseeable future.
That's interesting, because I was at the anti-war protest in Washington a few weeks ago, and I met a group of people who had come from Minneapolis, and they are those that get arrested outside Alliant Tech for their manufacturing of landmines. And also, I believe, of cluster bombs. I think they're the only company in this country that makes cluster bombs, that manufactured them for the bombing of Yugoslavia.
I believe it. They continue, and their argument is as long as there are defense forces, as long as the Defense Department requires products that they produce for our national security, they're going to continue to produce them.
You know, over the last few weeks, there's been a film festival in New York at Lincoln Center called the Human Rights Watch Film Festival that goes on this week as well. And before every film that they show on whatever subject, they have these very short shorts, like 3 minutes, 2 minutes, 4 minutes, that are put out by Handicap International. And they're little films about landmines to remind us all. And one that a friend was just telling me about involves a French upper-class family walking down the road. The parents are arguing about something, not paying much attention to their boys who are romping behind them. And the boys go off into the woods, and they find something that looks brightly colored, and they start hitting it with sticks, and it explodes, and the parents hear them screaming. And they run over, and it's extremely gory. But as the film ends, it says, "This would not happen to this family because this is not where landmines are put." Can you talk about where landmines are in the world?
Well, landmines are usually, initially they're deployed by the military in border areas, such as the Serbian forces in Kosovo along the border areas, either to deter an invasion or slow one up if one occurs. But the main problem is with non-professional forces, say paramilitias or civilians, rebels who deploy mines, say, in farms and houses, with the basic goal to destabilize the social environment. And that's where the main problem with mines in Kosovo are going to occur. And that's the main problem with mines in countries like Angola, Afghanistan, Cambodia, where mines are deployed in not a very systematic fashion, to deploy it haphazardly in an ad hoc way by numerous groups. So going in to clear these mines or going back home as a returning refugee, there's really not a plan on where not to go or what type of deployments there or what type of mines are there. It's very ad hoc and dispersed over a wide area, and so one never knows. So usually mines are deployed in those areas where there is social instability.
Finally, Ken Rutherford, if people want to get involved in the landmine treaty issue, I remember when Jody Powell and the International Campaign to Ban Landmines won the Nobel Peace Prize a few years ago, she was waiting for a call of congratulations from President Clinton, but she didn't get one. What would you suggest that people do? She had some choice words for what she would say to President Clinton about the fact that the U.S. had not signed off on the landmine treaty.
I think there's two things specifically. One is to, if one would tap into our website, landminesurvivors.org, landmine survivors is one word, we have on that website the whole treaty. We have different briefs on what people could do about it and where landmine use under international law stands. So it's an educational device. We have different sites on educating people on what the treaty is all about, the U.S. position. You'll also see what we did on March 1st, 1999, when the treaty entered in force, when 15 Americans came to Washington, D.C., who lost limbs to landmines in four different wars and civilians. So that would be educating the listener on the landmine issue. And number two is to make landmines a campaign issue. If you meet a presidential candidate somewhere along the campaign trail, ask him or her about the landmine position. Elizabeth Dole took a very strong stand on landmines when she was president of the American Red Cross, but I don't think she's made a statement about since declaring her candidacy. Al Gore, a Vietnam vet, served in Vietnam where over 50,000 of our casualties were due to mines or booby traps or unexploded ordnance, so that would be an interesting question to pose to the vice president.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Ken Rutherford, for being with us. Do you have a phone number or website that people can contact Ken Rutherford, co-founder of the Landmine Survivors Network?
I would recommend our website. It's landminesurvivors.org. And it's a great website. And our telephone number is 202-661-3537.
Ken Rutherford, thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Thank you. And you're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Again, you can go to the Pacifica website to find all website information of our guests as well as phone numbers. And that's easy to remember. It's www.pacifica.org. When we come out, a speak out after the bombing of Yugoslavia ends, but the occupation of Kosovo continues. And then you'll hear the most remarkable story of a young man, well, he was young when he went into prison, 17 years old, Michael Pardue, and why it is that he continues to serve a life sentence without possibility of parole after his conviction on a triple murder count was thrown out. He remains in prison because he had tried to escape. Stay with us.
You invite me to a war party. Slaves, but not quite so you kill off the remains. You look for me, I'm looking for you. I can't believe what they say about you is true, that you're a bastard just like Pharaoh. You kill the children just like Pharaoh. Now you send a ticket for me, it don't have RSVP. Oh Lord, it's a war party.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. And by the way, a special welcome to the listeners of WZRD in Chicago, Illinois, who've just started running Democracy Now! Every day, Monday through Friday. In fact, this weekend, I got a chance to go to Chicago. And while there, I spoke at a Chicago Socialist Summer School Conference. But since I'd gotten there early, I got a chance to hear what people at this conference, hundreds of them from around the country, had to say. The event was sponsored by the International Socialist Organization, and there were many issues covered that went through centuries and also through many topics today. One note, the story we just did on the soldiers who were killed in Pristina, what I didn't mention is that these soldiers who were clearing landmines and booby traps from a school that set off an explosion were two Nepalese Gurkhas and two civilians. These are soldiers from the 69th Gurkha Field Squadron, riflemen from Nepal attached to the British NATO force. And while this only happened yesterday, it's interesting that at one of the speakouts on Kosovo, one of the first people to stand up talked about this very issue. And today we're going to just play some of the comments of the students and activists from around the country and their concerns about where we stand after the bombing of Yugoslavia ends.
I found an article in Thursday's Chicago Tribune that I think should make clearer to anyone with reasoning capacity the barbarous nature of this war. And I think this also will speak to the first Dennis's point. We were asked to believe all along that the NATO mission was to relieve suffering and turn Kosovo into the safe place for ethnic Albanians to return to. So the bombing began and accelerated over time to reach its peak, as Paul said, after the peace agreement was signed. And then now they're claiming victory and they're running around saying, well, look, the Albanians get to go home. They're finally rescued, etc. But if you look at Kosovo right now, you can see this is a complete farce. Not only is it largely destroyed, but even the Chicago Tribune is realizing that after peace, it is the most dangerous place on earth. And I want to read just a little bit out of this. It says, Kosovo has replaced Cambodia, Bosnia, and Afghanistan as the world's most dangerous place for mines and explosives because of the lethal seeding of the land by all sides of the conflict. NATO mine clearers estimate there are hundreds of thousands of mines, as well as a number of unexploded alliance bombs, dotting a province the size of Connecticut. And then skipping ahead a little bit, Kosovo is a very, very dangerous place because of mines, said British Brigadier John Hoskinson, who was in charge of the mammoth mine clearing operation. A military source said Kosovo had replaced other mineful nations as the most dangerous place on earth because clearing was already underway in places such as Cambodia. And these mines and bombs, it says, can fragment when they explode, spraying metal and spewing out as many as 600 ball bearings. So I think it's clear that returning to Albania, to the most dangerous place on earth, because of this NATO intervention, is not something that the Albanians should or will be happy about.
We have never made any apologies whatsoever for the Milosevic regime or Serbian nationalism and the vicious oppression and ethnic cleansing which has taken place in Kosovo. But I think we have to be absolutely clear who the main propagators of violence are in this situation, and that is NATO. I mean, you can look at this in a number of respects. Look at the number of civilians that NATO killed during this war. The rate of death was much higher than the deaths in the what was going on in Kosovo before this war began. And even though NATO pilots were not face to face with the people that they killed, they knew exactly what they were doing. There's actually a very interesting article. People should check it out. It's on the Z Web website on the internet. It's titled "Spanish Fighter Pilots Admit NATO Purposely Attacks Civilian Targets," and it's a report from some of the Spanish troops that are involved that were disgusted by what they were being told to do, and you know, talked about the way in which attacking civilian targets was part of NATO's strategy in this whole thing. It's their way of trying to demoralize the opposition in the war. And as for the refugees, you know, as Cinder pointed out, NATO created the refugee crisis in the first place. I mean, the quote that Paul read from Robert Fisk is absolutely right. There were plaudits for the refugees going back. There weren't a million refugees at the start of this war. They caused it. And in fact, they as much as admitted this. Claire Short, there's the British Minister for Overseas Development. You can just see what they mean by overseas development, right? Dropping bombs. She said on TV, she was asked, why didn't NATO make any preparations for the refugee crisis before it began? And she said, well, we couldn't do that because if we had done that, it would have looked like we knew that it was going to happen. And then people would have said that we were responsible for it. Well, they did know it was going to happen. Wesley Clark admitted that the day after the refugees started pouring out. He said, yeah, we knew this was going to happen. Of course it was going to happen. But they wanted to pretend that they had no responsibility for it, and hence they did nothing to prepare for it. And throughout the war, there were it was peanuts were being thrown at the refugees, and billions of dollars going into prosecuting the war effort. And the sad thing is that that's going to continue now that we have the so-called peace, because they're going to continue pouring money into the military, into the whole militarization of the area. I mean, look at what's happened at Bosnia, where only 10% of people have been able to return to their homes. And the devastation in Kosovo is actually much worse than it was in Bosnia, because Bosnia didn't have a 2.5 month bombing campaign with cluster bombs being dropped over the territory. So I think, you know, that is the, you know, that's the real situation there. We have to say NATO created this problem. They created it over the long term with the Western intervention in the area, starting with the IMF programs in the 1980s. They're the ones that lit the flames which allowed nationalism to grow in Serbia and Croatia and the rest. And this peace which they are now imposing is not any real peace. We can't celebrate it in any sense whatsoever.
Yes, Paul started by talking about Crassus, the Roman who made a fortune by putting out fires when offering to buy the buildings at a low cost before he would put out the fires. In a sense, NATO take this one stage further. They make Crassus is also the arsonist who starts the fire in order to then put it out and then buy it cheaply. And that's the truth of the matter, because if we look back to the roots of the descent into hell in the former Yugoslavia, as somebody said earlier on, those roots are entirely related to the collapse of the economy, to the IMF intervention, to the austerity measures, to the 150% inflation, to the 15% unemployment, to the food rationing and so on, which produced and presented a fantastic mobilization of workers against their government, against what was happening. And in those circumstances, the alternative, as far as the ruling class of the region or elements of the ruling class of the regions were concerned, against that sort of mobilization, anti-bank, anti-IMF, potentially, in other words, anti-capitalist movement, they played with nationalist demagogy. Both Milosevic and Tudjman and others in the region offer as an alternative to people, rather than fighting back against the system that's destroying their lives, blame the Serbs, blame the Albanians, blame the Croatians, blame somebody else. It's nothing to do with the system. And the truth of the matter is that at that point, I mean, I listened to a radio program very early in Britain, very early in the war, where there was a well-known and respected columnist from a right-wing magazine called The Spectator. And somebody said, well, why did the West do nothing when there were these huge anti-Milosevic demonstrations, this massive movement? He said, what massive movement? What anti-Milosevic demonstration? He wasn't even aware it had happened, because the truth of the matter is that if the West had to choose between Milosevic and, as they would see it, the mob, they were going to choose Milosevic every time. And they chose Milosevic every time until it suited their purposes to turn on Milosevic. Now, I think if we understand that, we then have to come to the very serious point, and it was the one raised again and again, the one I think, Dennis, is it? Again and again during the war, about the plight of the Kosovo Albanians, that the anti-war movement didn't care, that surely Milosevic was worse and so on. I think there's a number of things we have to say. I can't think, if a war was to be conducted to liberate the Kosovo Albanians, to save them from their plight, I can't think of a more inappropriate way to wage a war than the war that was waged. I can't think of a more inappropriate way to fight such a battle if that was really what the intention was. Because what's the reality? And then here I really do reject the notion that somehow high-tech mass murder is morally superior to low-tech crude murder. I don't believe it for a minute. The fact that large numbers of people died in hospitals, schools, trains, buses, old people's homes, children in blocks of flats, that's somehow different because the pilot didn't see who he was killing. We don't know whether he gloated or not, because he was 15,000 feet up. We have no idea what was going on. I don't believe there's something superior about that. In fact, in many ways, potentially it's the most terrifying type of war, because it says we can do this. We can wage wars at no physical cost to ourselves. There's no fear of us dying. We're safe. We will wage these wars. It is, in a sense, much more amoral than any other war that's fought. Paul described it as a coward's war. The second thing is something that somebody's already said. What's now there? What is this victory to return home? Claire Short, who somebody mentioned, who actually, incidentally, at the beginning of the crisis of the refugees, said that she didn't want one refugee to come to Britain, because she didn't want any to leave the area, because that would be a victory for Milosevic, who, given that he's supposed to be the new Hitler, one dreads to think what she'd have advised the Jews to do in the 1930s. Stay as close to the German border as possible, because anything else is a victory for Hitler. Does not really seem to me to make much sense, if that's what it's about. But the reality is that she says it will take at least 2 years, and Robert Fisk is right. It's amazing. I mean, I remember when I was a student, we were in an occupation, we fought over all sorts of demands, we didn't win one of them, but we got a clause saying that the fact that we'd been in occupation, we wouldn't be victimised, and we proclaimed that as a victory. Now, I didn't notice to anybody that had we never occupied in the first place, we wouldn't have needed this no victimisation clause, which we were then claiming as a victory, and in a sense it's like that. Every refugee who returns is a victory, except that you are responsible, your actions, for the fact that so many left in the first place. If we understand that and then say, what are they returning to? To a destroyed infrastructure, a destroyed economy, and a destroyed ecology. The use of depleted uranium means that not only this generation of Kosovo Albanians, but future generations of Kosovo Albanians are likely to suffer deformity, and so on and so forth. We can see just how depraved a war it was and how inappropriate a war it was to free anyone.
Okay, Bill is going to be followed by his comrade here in the brown shirt.
A lot has been said about the current situation with the refugees, and I don't want to go on much longer, but just to say how important it is to take into account the current facts. I mean, look in the front page of the Chicago Tribune today. The main story there is about, on the one hand, NATO being unable to prevent Kosovo Albanians who've been in the camps from returning on their own initiative under circumstances that are going to be chaotic. At the same time, these troops are saying it's going to be months before these people can return. NATO officials said some of the 850,000 who were driven from Kosovo by Yugoslav forces during the 78-day NATO air war would have to remain outside the province for many months to come. And of course we would be happy if those people could go back to anything like decent housing and decent homes. But even on NATO's own terms now, it's not happening. I mean, what's there to be proud about? What's there to be happy about in any way? That's what I think has to be made clear now. And then just to go on to another point, I mean, Paul rightly says it's up to the people in the region to decide what the current political and social shape of the Balkans is going to be. This is something that politicians like Clinton are absolutely set against allowing to happen. There's an article in the New York Times yesterday, very small article, I don't know if you saw it, saying Clinton had signed a CIA directive for a plan to destabilize the Milosevic regime. Now, we know from Iraq what these kind of CIA plans are likely to yield, you know. And it's so hypocritical the game that Clinton is playing now. On the one hand, he celebrates the indictment of Milosevic as a war crime, a war criminal. On the other hand, he says, well, as to actually arresting the guy, I don't know whether that can be done. I don't know whether that would be a good idea, because clearly that doesn't allow him the kind of political control. But I think we'll launch a CIA initiative to see what we can do to bring somebody into power there a little bit more to our liking. I mean, this is what we have to expect in the future. And even if the bombs are not falling, those of us in the anti-war movement have got a very important battle, especially with people who are not going to want to take that kind of manipulation on Clinton's part on. That's for us to do.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Just in terms of the argument about, well, didn't something have to be done? Wasn't it necessary? I mean, that was really the hardest argument I think we ran up against in the anti-war movement. People are like, I don't like the bombing. God knows I don't trust Clinton. I think he's lying to me. I think he's doing it for alternative reasons. But God, don't we have to do something to help the refugees? And even if you said, well, NATO created the refugee crisis to begin with, people then turn around and say, well, even if they created it, and it was a mistake, and they really screwed up, don't they now have the responsibility to do something about it and fix it? And that whole line of argument, you can see where it leads. Because if you accept that line of argument, then whatever NATO does, the only solution is NATO doing something else. And that really hamstrings why be an anti-war activist. And so it destroys the anti-war movement. And I think what it is based on is a complete ignorance of the struggles in the region that have happened in the last few years. I mean, people just remember 10 years back, the entire Stalinist regional empire disintegrated in a matter of months. Just across the border, a very nasty dictator, very much like Milosevic, named Ceausescu, was lined up against the wall and shot with his wife. The potential for dramatic and fast fast radical change against these nationalist brutal regimes is very real. In the winter protests of 1996-97, hundreds of days in a row of tens of thousands of people fighting the Milosevic regime. And this is at a time when Richard Holbrooke's position is, well, Milosevic is the kind of man we can do business with in the Balkans. You know, that NATO did everything it could, as somebody said, to choose Milosevic over the mob. And it wasn't just happening in Serbia. It wasn't just the mass protests there, which are not just Serbian people, but are tons of different ethnicities which live in Serbia. At the same time, there's a massive resistance movement going on to Milosevic's police state in Kosovo. So you have hundreds of thousands of Albanians resisting the Serb police state. And one of the things that happened, which you can see some of the hope, in this winter of 1997, Serbian police officer in Kosovo shot and killed an Albanian teacher. And at one of the big protests in Belgrade that had, the protesters had a moment of silence in Belgrade for the Kosovan teacher who'd been killed by the Serbian paramilitaries. And that is the potential. Those little instances are the sparks that we have to look to as the only solution. When Paul talks about, you know, is it a pipe dream that the peoples of the region can come together? And when you listen to the politicians, they just go, ha, 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 these people can't come together. They're savages. They've been savages for hundreds of years. And if anybody knows, I mean, the level of education and sophistication in many of these places is very high. Very worldly people know lots about politics. What NATO did was destroy that spark. What NATO did was do everything it could to destroy the ability of those people to come together. And despite that, day after day after day, out of Serbia came proclamations from the non-governmental organizations, from the Women in Black, who said, we still want to unite with our Kosovan brothers and sisters. We still hate Milosevic. We've been driven underground. And I'll tell you that for the time being, it looks grim, but the potential for those struggles to be reborn rather quickly, I think more quickly than people expect, is very real. And it will also be affected by the class struggles in the region. If Greece blows up into a general strike, if Italy goes, if Hungary goes, it will inspire people to retake to the streets and get rid of Milosevic. And that is the only way. And I fully expect when those struggles start that the NATO troops who are stationed in Kosovo will do everything they can to put it down.
Students and activists this weekend at DePaul University in Chicago speaking at a socialist summer school. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And don't go away, because when we come back from our break, a story you won't forget. Stay with us.
They say everything can be replaced. They say every distance is not near. So I remember every face of every man who put me here. I see my life come shining from the west down to the east any day now, any day now. I shall be released.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Well, while in Chicago this past weekend, I had a chance to meet the wife of Michael Pardue. He was 17 years old in Alabama, and after a coerced confession by police, he was convicted of a triple murder. Well, 25 years later, he was cleared of the crimes. In 1997, Alabama's highest courts ordered the state to give Pardue a fair trial or drop the charges, and the state dropped all those charges. But he remains in prison for life, without possibility of parole, for trying to escape. Meet Becky Pardue.
My name is Becky Pardue. I'm the wife of Michael Pardue, currently in an Alabama maximum security prison for no crime but escaping an illegal incarceration. He is in his 27th consecutive year in prison.
How long have you been married?
We met in 1983 and have been together as a unit since then.
Can you tell me your husband's story?
Very briefly, it's a long and complicated story, obviously, but in 1973, he was a 17-year-old with alone, no parents, without influence, poor.
two high-profile crimes had been committed in the area. He had, on the same night, stolen two tires and a pickup truck. So they had him in a small-town jail during this period, questioning him about the theft of the truck and the tires, which he admitted freely. As the hours of the interrogation turned into days, they started talking more and more about murders that occurred, of which he knew nothing. As those days turned into almost a week, at the end of 80 hours after being beaten, denied food and drink, having two attorneys turned away, having been under an incommunicado interrogation continually for nearly 80 hours, he confessed to crimes he didn't commit, of which he knew nothing. He simply regurgitated the facts that the police had given him throughout the previous days. This case was, it brought together all the worst elements of a wrongful conviction. He was alone. He was poor. We had prosecutors willing to manufacture and alter evidence, which we have proven. We have prosecutors compelling witnesses to commit perjury. They have altered evidence. They have created evidence. Subsequent to Michael's conviction, the district attorney, the chief investigator were both sentenced into the federal penitentiary and went to federal penitentiary for drug smuggling. The district attorney that handled the case, the assistant district attorney, was imprisoned for bribery and jury tampering. These were criminals in 1973 who conspired and successfully convicted an innocent 17-year-old. Michael tried with a ninth grade education to appeal his conviction. His court-appointed attorney had been previous to becoming a defending attorney, was a prosecutor, and in the same county had a history of being a prosecuting district attorney, and he was the best friend of the current prosecuting attorney. There was a capital murder trial that lasted an hour and a half. He filed for no discovery. He had no defense witnesses. And they brought forward the confession that was taken after the 80 hours of Michael, and he was convicted. He tried to appeal with a ninth grade education, tried to appeal his conviction. This same appointed attorney withdrew the appeal without Michael's knowledge or consent. Mike gave up. He laid down and gave up. 10 years into his incarceration in 1983, we met. And that's a long story. I won't go into that. Fell in love. Committed ourselves to fighting this horrid nightmare. And we set about it. I became a detective. He became a paralegal. We gathered all the information. It was really a battle because the authorities didn't want us to have information. They didn't want us to have the documents, the forensic, the autopsy reports, everything that had been withheld for all these years that proved Michael was innocent. They fought me tooth and nail. It took me years and years and years to gather the information that subsequently freed Michael the charges. Mike filed pro se. We started, of course, in the lower courts, in the circuit courts, and went up, all the way up to the federal court, and won on a pro se habeas corpus without the aid of an attorney, because I can't afford an attorney for such a huge case. We did it ourselves. All the cases were reversed. We won. Everything in 1973 was ruled unconstitutional and illegal. At that point, he had been in prison now for 22 years for something he clearly did not do. The state of Alabama dropped charges altogether. End of story? No.
What year?
1991. What happened in 1987 is that Michael gave up hope. He lost heart, understandably, in a system that had failed him profoundly. He gave up hope and he escaped. It was a nonviolent escape. He threatened no one. However, they threw not just the book at him, they threw the whole law library at him and sentenced him to life without parole. That was in 1987. Okay, let's move back forward to 1991 when we had the original crimes reversed as unconstitutional. We thought, we're going home. We are going home. We were thrilled. The cases were reversed and we had to go up for resentencing on the escape charges. So
I bought homecoming clothes. I thought he was coming home. They could not admit they're wrong. They did not have the integrity or the backbone to say, we've done something horrid. We have stolen 22 years of your life. I'm sorry. Go home. They didn't do that. They resentenced Mike on the escape charge, life without parole. He is sentenced to die today for nothing but a nonviolent escape from an illegal incarceration. And today he sits in a cage, entering his 27th consecutive year, for nothing but escaping a place he should have never been to begin with. And that's where we are today.
How many times did he try to escape?
He escaped three times. He escaped in 1977, very briefly. He escaped in 1978, all completely nonviolent, all innocuous. He's a gentleman. But by God, he's in prison for something he didn't do. Given the opportunity to run away without violence or without hurting anyone, he's going to take the opportunity. The last time he ran away, he spent a day and a half with his father, who was dying and subsequently died within that year. And he's a humane individual, but he deserves his freedom. And he took it when he could. And a day or two of freedom here and there has cost him possibly the rest of his life.
Is there any place to appeal this to at this point?
Mm-hmm. We are. We will not give up. We will not let them win is our motto. What we've done, we've attacked all the escape charges with every bit of zeal and passion we have. We have some indication at this point that the Alabama Supreme Court may reverse the one of the escape charges, which kills the Habitual Offender Act. He has this, everyone knows about the Three Strikes Act. So if we only get one of the priors reversed, one of the escape charges reversed, then he'll be eligible for parole and a pardon in any number of areas of relief.
Was he sentenced to life in prison without parole, despite the fact that everything was reversed, because he had tried to escape three times? That was the three strikes?
Yes. The three strikes were the three escapes. Everything else, initially, they used the murders to enhance his 1987 escape to life without parole. But then when all of those crimes from 1973 were found unconstitutional, instead of doing what is right, instead of allowing him to use that time and say, give him time served for this nonviolent escape, they went back and picked up the two prior escapes, called him an habitual offender, and sentenced him to life without parole.
Could the Alabama governor now grant him clemency?
He could not. He could not. However, we know he could pick up the phone and Michael would be free tomorrow. Politics anywhere is like that. The governor had it in his soul to be compassionate, or he had it in his soul to see that this is an egregious, hard situation, he could pick up the telephone to free Michael. However, in terms of law, as it's stated in Alabama, the governor doesn't have clemency rights except in death penalty cases. So at this point, he cannot have parole. It's quite a catch-22. He cannot be paroled because people with life without parole can't be paroled. He can't be pardoned because life without parole cannot be pardoned, and the governor has no jurisdiction over the case.
Do you have any indication that if one of the three escapes were, if the charges for one of the three escapes were dropped, that the Alabama governor would then grant him clemency?
I've had no indication of that at all.
Who is on your side?
We have a grassroots organization throughout the world. In fact, not only in this country, but throughout the globe, who are writing letters, who are calling, who are working for us, who understand the incredible injustice that's at work here, and know that if it can happen to Mike Pardew, it can happen to any of us and any of them. So we do have a good deal of support. Whether or not Alabama will cave in is another issue.
Wirt, do you have a website? A phone number that people can find out about his case?
Yes. Our website is quite long, but it's /members.aol.com/ChristyHW/Pardew
www.michaelpardue.htm. That's very long. I think if they would search on Michael Pardue, they could probably come up with it.
And folks, get out your pencils, because in a minute I will repeat that website. Is there a phone number that people can call and the name of an organization?
Yes, there's our phone number, and I will answer all calls. It's area code 334-990-7031. We have a petition campaign going on. If you'll please call and ask for petitions. We think that Alabama, now given enough pressure from people who would protest this, I believe it can make an effect. We need everyone's help. We need signatures. We need letters. We need phone calls to the authorities in Alabama who could do something at this point.
And have you tapped into other movements, for example, around the death penalty or around prisons and prison reform?
Well, only in the recent past with ISO and organizations fighting the death penalty. And Alabama's a little isolated. There is not a progressive movement. There's not a liberal movement in Alabama that would fight something like this. There are a lot of individuals floundering and seeking help, but they're not unified in the South as they are here.
Are you working with an attorney?
We have attorneys that are working pro bono. Only since the New York Times, we had a front page New York Times story, which is quite good, come out in May of last year. Only since then have we attracted a very large firm from Washington, D.C., who's working pro bono. We have an attorney from Birmingham as well that's working pro bono for us.
And what kind of media coverage have you gotten?
We've gotten tremendous media coverage. We got a whole hour on Dateline. We've been on the Lisa Show. We've been on CBS, NBC, CBS Eye on America, the This Morning Show, the Today Show, and then we've been in newspapers around the globe.
You know, in so many of these cases, people get no media attention. So I'm curious, in your case, where you've gotten so much corporate media, mainstream media attention, what effect has it had?
I don't know that it's helped much, aside from the fact that people do know, and letters and petitions at some point must have an effect. It just must.
Finally, in terms of the prison reform movement, the anti-death penalty movement, so many of the cases that people have rallied around are cases of African Americans and people of color in prison, because there is this disproportionate number of people of color in prison. Often, when we talk about that, we also say as well as poor white people in prison. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the population that Michael Pardue is incarcerated with, what is their economic status and what color are they?
Generally speaking, the overwhelming proportion of men and women in prison in the South as well as across the country are black. I don't think it's a matter of color. I think it's a matter of economics and education. It wouldn't have mattered if Mike were green, purple, or orange. The fact that he was without influence, money, or assistance defined him as a victim, and that remains true.
What keeps you going?
I love him desperately, profoundly in love with this gentle and kind man who needs help, and I will never give up until he walks free.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. And one more time, if you can give out that website, as people have their pens or pencils in hand now. And folks, this website doesn't have a www with it.
Okay, it is http://members.aol.com/ Christy, Christy HW/Pardue, Pardue, .htm.
Becky Pardue, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And the phone number again of Becky Pardue, the wife of Michael Pardue, is 334-990-7031. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call the archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And if you missed the website, all of our information, websites, phone numbers of all the guests are always on our website at www.pacifica.org. You can also hear Democracy Now! Online by clicking on that website. Well, that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland is our technical director. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Of every man who put me here.